A new year is full of surprises, but one thing is always predictable. Postage costs go up. Stamps.com gives you crazy discounts of up to 89% off USPS and UPS services. So when postage goes up, your business will barely notice the change. Stamps.com is like your own personal post office, wherever you are. You can even take care of orders on the go with the mobile app. No lines, no traffic, no waiting. Schedule package pickups, automatically find the cheapest and fastest shipping options, and seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. There's even a supply store where you can stock up on mailing supplies, labels, even printers. Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses just like yours. All you need is a computer or phone and printer. Take a chunk out of your mailing and shipping costs this year with Stamps.com. Sign up with promo code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com code PROGRAM.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, I speak to actress Zendaya and director Sam Levinson about their COVID-compliant new movie, Malcolm and Marie, on Netflix. All about a couple at home having an argument. Maybe not one for lockdown, but let's see. I chat to the director of a fascinating new documentary called Assassins, all about the two women accused of the murder of Kim Jong-un's half-brother. And Sheila Shoigan drops by to chat about her favourite movie. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the News Talk app, or wherever you choose to get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. Hope you're doing okay. Hope February so far is treating you well. Now, there was big news, of course, with the Golden Globes this week, and success for Daisy Edgar Jones, not for Paul Mescal, unfortunately, but for Daisy for Normal People, and also for Wolfwalkers, which I was delighted about, because Wolfwalkers from Cartoon Saloon is a fantastic film. The animation in that movie is, it's timeless. It really is. It reminded me of something I'd watch as a kid. You know, like the original Lord of the Rings cartoon or something. And I don't mean that it's dated or anything. I mean that it's timeless. It's a beautiful movie. So I was delighted to see that. Well-deserved. And indeed the second nomination for Cartoon Saloon from the Golden Globes. Let's hope they take home the prize. Now, in TV, I'm slightly late to the party, but I wanted to mention to you, It's a Sin. You may have heard about this. You may already have watched it all. It's on Channel 4. You can stream it all, download it all from the Channel 4 app. And It's a Sin is created by Russell T. Davis. And it's about a group of primarily young men, although there are women in it as well, but young men who come to London in the early 80s. Most of them are gay. And it's about their lives that they've left behind in places like the Isle of Wight. And they come to London and they slowly embrace a gay lifestyle and experience joy in coming out, essentially. But mirrored with that and in tandem with that is the slow, tragic entry of AIDS into the world, basically. And this is just brilliantly made television. There's this quiet, slow creeping dread as this bizarre virus that no one really understands slowly makes its way into the gay community and starts wreaking havoc. Now, that would be a lot to take. It's only 5 episodes long. So if it was just about AIDS, that would be a very hard watch, albeit a very important watch. But as I say, in tandem with this is the lives of these young people finally being able to express themselves and the little petty jealousies they have with their friends and pals and colleagues. It's a really great piece of TV. It's an important piece of TV as well. The music as well is amazing because it's an 80s soundtrack, and even the title, I guess, is partially borrowed from the Pet Shop Boys. It's brilliant television. You should watch it. I'm only 3 episodes in, so I've 2 left to go. It's in very poignant, very sad at times, also kind of joyful at times as well, as I've been saying. It's a Sin. Watch it now. Brilliant. Best thing I've seen this year. Now, this year is only 5 weeks old, but 3 episodes in, It's immense. It really is. A lot of people in touch last week. A lot of people in touch on Twitter and also on text saying how much they enjoyed The Dig on Netflix that we reviewed last week and giving us a thumbs up for recommending. A lot of people have really enjoyed The Dig. This is the one with Ralph Fiennes and Kerry Mulligan on Netflix, all about this archaeological dig right on the eve of World War II in Suffolk. Sounds kind of dull. It's far from it. It's a lovely, lovely movie that we gave 4 stars. And a lot of people were glad with our review and went to watch it. I'll bring you one. It was from Catherine from Cork, who said, "I watched The Dig last night and loved it." And there was a few of those as well. I also got an email, and you can email the show at any stage, screentime@newstalk.com. From a Chris Mannion, who asked me, did I ever watch Night of the Demon from 1957, starring Dave Andrews and Peggy Cummins? I haven't, Chris, but thank you for the recommendation. I've heard of that, and I've heard that it's one of those unexpectedly great horror movies from the 50s, Night of the Demon. So if time allows, I will get to that soon. I promise. And talking of favourite movies and all, incidentally, for reasons I won't bore you with, I had to write 3,000 words this week for a publication about my favourite film. And as I've said to you before, my favourite film is The Royal Tenenbaums by Wes Anderson, when I'm asked to choose one occasionally. So if you've never watched The Royal Tenenbaums, you should watch it and report back to me. Okay, I'll say no more than that.
Malcolm, I feel like once you know someone is there for you and once you know they love you, you never actually think of them again. It's not until you're about to lose someone that you finally pay attention.
Well, what is it, Marie? What do you want?
Really? Do you want to go there?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, that was a clip from Malcolm and Marie, which lands on Netflix this Friday. That's the 5th of February. Now, this is an interesting movie in that it was pretty much the only, or certainly one of the few movies made entirely in COVID conditions. And when I say the only movie, as in a proper, you know, Hollywood kind of production, or certainly one of the few. And it's about a couple called Malcolm and Marie. Malcolm is a pretty self-involved film director, and Marie is his partner. She's a good bit younger than him. And they come home after the premiere of his movie, and they kind of have a long and rambling and pretty intense, but also pretty lighthearted at times, argument essentially about their relationship. It has a lot to do with the fact that he forgot to thank her in his speech. As I say, it was filmed in lockdown, and it's very much a lockdown movie because it takes place entirely in a house. That's the only location of it, and the camera moves between the rooms. Now, it stars Zendaya, that fine young actress who was also a singer. She started kind of life as a child model, and then in Disney TV shows, she's been in Spider-Man Homecoming. She's only in her 20s, but she's done a huge amount. And the man, the Malcolm character, is played by John David Washington, who we saw most recently in Tenet and a fine actor. And it's directed by Sam Levinson. Sam Levinson is the son of the great Barry Levinson. And these two actors and director know each other very well because they star and direct in Euphoria, that HBO series that stopped after one season because of COVID. They were all ready to shoot the second. So Zendaya suggested to Sam Levinson, "Let's do a movie, because we were going to make the second season of Euphoria, so why not make a movie?" And that's what they did. Now, as I say, it's a pretty intense movie. It might not be for everyone, particularly in lockdown, because it's about people in a house arguing. But there's a lot going on, and there's a lot of cool cinematic touches in it I really enjoyed. There's also a great diatribe against film critics, which I couldn't help laugh at, even though I guess I'm technically one myself. Anyway, I got to chat to Zendaya and director Sam Levinson earlier in the week. Hi there. Zendaya, if I could start with you, it's a pretty intense movie and it's a great movie. I'm wondering, was
Thank
it
you.
An intense experience? You know, you're there with John 16 days. There's not many people around. The material is full on. It must have been intense.
No, it definitely was intense, but I think it was also so much fun. We really did enjoy each other's company because I think, A, we were so grateful to be able to be working. I think this is an extremely tough time for everybody. So just the fact that we could be safely around each other and be doing what we love to do, I think was a gift. but I think bigger than that, I think we were so excited to be creating something I think we were all proud of, that we all put our kind of heart and our soul and our, you know, blood, sweat and tears into, you know, something that felt like, you know, a family, something that felt like a safe place for us to be creative and try things. And there's that, you know, there's no sense of, you know, bad idea or a table that's off, like, you know, a conversation that's off the table. I think we all just, you know, we're really able to be vulnerable and honest and create something I think that we're all proud of. So with that being said, although there was obviously a level of intensity because of the time frame, because of all the work that had to be done and the minimal amount of people we had to do it, because of the material, I think, yeah, that's natural. But because of the group of people we were doing it with and how we approached it, I think it created such a beautiful environment to do that kind of work. And I actually, you know, it was a challenge that was one of the most special and rewarding and fun experiences too of my life.
And Sam, you know, a lot has been made about the fact that it was done during COVID and there was all the precautions and all that kind of thing. But I was also thinking that there might have been some pleasure to it because it was such a small shoot. There was no location scouting, I don't think, apart from the actual house. There was just the two actors, both very nice people. Obviously, one of them's here. But I mean, despite the COVID nature of it, there was probably a pleasure in the size of what you had to do as well.
I think absolutely. There was a certain freedom because we didn't have to answer to anyone other than each other, because we all kind of put our own money into it, because it was, you know, our Euphoria crew. There was a kind of familial feeling to it. So I think that allowed a certain exploration and experimentation just naturally, where we could try things, we can reshoot things if we didn't like the way that it had gone the day before. It was sort of a beautiful experience.
Yeah. And Sam, I have to ask, you know, my wife turned to me and smiled at the funniest bit in the movie where John David's character is having a diatribe, a very funny one, I felt, against a film critic. And, you know, my wife was saying, he's talking about you, and we both laughed. And, you know, I guess I am a film critic, but was that you having a little fun, or was it just you thinking, you know, so much that's written about film is overblown, pretentious crap?
I don't know. I think that what's funny about the scene to me is it's a great review that he gets.
Yeah, and he does. She calls it a masterwork or something. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tour de force. It's a masterwork. But because of, you know, how sensitive he is, it completely unmoors him as a character, because he's getting praise, but not in the way in which he wants the praise. Now, do I think that there's certain, you know, there's a certain validity to the things that he's saying about politicizing a piece because it doesn't star someone who looks like you? Absolutely. But I think the intention of the scene is to kind of show his total, vulnerability and in some senses his complete like egomania. And to further compound it, Marie agrees with the critic, but takes it even a step further by saying her problem with you as a filmmaker is my problem with you as a human being. I think it could be looked at a number of ways.
Yeah. And then just quickly, Zendaya, what's next for you? I feel like I've been watching you for years and you're only in your 20s. It's bizarre, but I'm wondering what your next project is.
Right now I'm in Atlanta shooting Spider-Man. So I am in the Spidey world right now. But which I love and I have a lot of fun here. But I don't know. I think we have another season of Euphoria, which I'm very excited about. And that should be nice and tough, right, Sam?
Yeah.
So we have that to look forward to, but I don't have a very specific plan I don't really kind of map anything out in that way. I really just try to find things that inspire me or push me as an artist. I mean, this was obviously not planned. This, I never thought I'd be able to do something like this. And here it is. So, with that being said, you know, I have to keep my mind open to what will also find me.
Yeah. Well, man makes plans and God laughs. So you did a great job on this, guys. Yeah. Thanks a lot for talking to me.
Of course.
Thank you.
Director Sam Levinson and the actress Zendaya there talking to me about their new movie, Malcolm and Marie, which is on Netflix as of this Friday. That's the 5th of February. Well worth a watch. It's heavy going, but I found it very entertaining. My wife didn't enjoy it at all. She had to leave, but I enjoyed it. It's definitely worth a watch. Heavy going, but very entertaining. The juice is worth the squeeze, I would suggest. Up next, a bizarre but riveting documentary all about the two women accused of the murder of Kim Jong-un's half-brother.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now I want to turn to a fascinating documentary called Assassins, which details the, well, highly reported assassination of Kim Jong-nam. That's the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. That took place in an airport in Malaysia in 2017 and saw two young women literally walk up to Kim Jong-nam and smear him with a deadly chemical. The women admitted doing it, but in a very strange twist, still claimed innocence in a case that has many more bizarre twists and turns. Assassins is available to view on IFI at home from Friday the 29th of January. And having watched it, I can tell you it's mesmerizing. It's directed by Ryan White, who also made the brilliant The Keepers on Netflix, which I know a lot of our listeners have enjoyed. And I'm delighted to say Ryan's on the line now. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm very well. Ryan, I mentioned that this was, you know, people were aware of this. We'd seen it certainly on this side of the pond, probably not as much as it was covered in the States, but people were aware of this. But I presume something happened or someone came to you with more information than just a newspaper article that got you involved in this.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you might be wrong about across the pond, because what happened here was the assassination was February of 2017, and that was just as Donald Trump was taking office. So it was a huge headline, two female assassins, you know, one of the biggest political assassinations of our lifetimes. But it was almost just a headline here. By the next day or 2 days later, it was gone because Donald Trump was dominating everything. So I think, like most Americans, I forgot about it. I had no idea what happened to those two women and whether I just assumed that they were a part of the North Korean regime in some way. But you are right that I was approached. So a few months later, a journalist named Doug Clark called me and said, "Remember that assassination? Well, I'm over in Malaysia and Indonesia investigating it. And there's a lot more to this story than what made international media a few months ago." And he's the one who let me know that the women had their murder trial coming up in Malaysia and that they were going to be entering a defense that said, "Yes, we assassinated Kim Jong-nam. We touched his face with a chemical weapon, which led to his death. But we thought we were on a reality show when we committed that assassination." And I mean, I'm a skeptic by nature. I'm a documentary filmmaker, so I think we mostly are skeptical. But a few months later, I was on a flight with Doug to Malaysia, because I thought, even if these women are lying, even if they aren't telling the truth and they're making this up, this is going to be an incredible murder trial. Like, it's the most unbelievable defense to enter. And so I decided I wanted to follow the murder trial and investigate. And, you know, I spent 2.5 years making the film. It only got weirder and more bizarre and more surreal as we continued filming. And that's Assassins. That's what the film is about.
By God, it does get weirder. And I'm very keen not to give spoilers, because there are certain almost Sixth Sense moments. I see dead people that I don't want to get into without giving a spoiler. I don't mean to make light of it either, because it's serious stuff. But that said, right, and you've said there that you were intrigued by these women. So let's park their innocence or guilt for now, and we won't discuss that, right? People can watch the movie themselves, and I hope they do. But what I was really taken with was, irrespective of if they did it knowingly or not, they seem like ripe people to be used in a scheme, if it was one, in terms of their backgrounds. One of them from Indonesia and the other one from Vietnam, that they were really the type of people that could get caught up in something like that. I presume that became quite apparent to you when you got a hand on who they were.
Yeah, they, I think at the center of this story is, whether you believe the women or not, at the center of the story is a universal story, which is the use of the internet and social media to exploit or manipulate. And both of these women, the women are very different from one another. Duan was from Vietnam. She had spent over a decade seeking a life of fame as an actress or as a singer. She was on Vietnam Idol. And Siti had a much harder backstory. You know, she was a single mom who had ended up in the sweatshop industry in Indonesia, and then ended up in the sex work industry in Kuala Lumpur, and was constantly seeking a better life and better paycheck to send money back to her family and son home in Indonesia. And so these men who claimed to be Japanese YouTube producers and ended up being North Korean spies preyed on those vulnerabilities in recruiting these two women. And we know now these weren't the only two women that were groomed. There were other women over the course of this year who also were recruited and were a part of this alleged prank show. But for whatever reason, Duan and Siti are the two that made it to the end and are the ones whose final prank was a fatal one. So, you know, it is, you know, true crime is a very interesting genre right now because it's very popular in the world of documentary. But in this story, we were always very careful to not get too lost in the spectacle, because it is a spectacle and it is very entertaining. You know, it is whatever the Kim regime orchestrated was orchestrated in a way that was supposed to be so surreal and bizarre. But there's a real victim at the center, which is Kim Jong-nam. He died and there was never any accountability or justice for that. And if you believe the women, there's two other victims who were facing this, the penalty of their lives as well. And so we were constantly reminding ourselves through the making of the film to not get lost in the spectacle, that the central thrust of our film was discovering who these women are, despite all the sensational headlines of these, you know, femme fatale Bond women, really figure out who they are and what led them to this moment in that airport.
Yeah, one of the kind of spine tingling moments of it is you have the CCTV footage and you can see, in essence, Kim Jong-nam die. You can see the women walking up. You can see it before and after. It's terrifying because obviously one knows what's going to happen when you're watching it, and to see everyone's reaction afterwards. Was it hard to get that footage?
It was very, very hard to get the CCTV footage. It took, you know, I made the film for 2.5 years. It wasn't until the final year that we got our hands on that footage. We tried so hard from every government agency in Malaysia, and we're always stonewalled. Even the lawyers, you know, some of the main characters in my film are the two defense teams for both women. They didn't have their hands on the full catalog of the CCTV footage at the beginning either, which is mind-blowing when they're supposed to defend their clients' lives in court, and yet they can't see the footage of how that day went down. You know, and so I can't say how we finally got the footage. It took it took a lot of back channeling, but when we finally got our hands on this massive stack of DVDs, you know, and we had to be very careful. Obviously, there were a lot of cybersecurity and physical safety risks with making the you know, a film about the North Korean regime. But when you're handed a stack of DVDs in a plastic bag, you want to be very careful with them. So, you know, we edited and uploaded those very, very carefully. It took months to piece together the thousands of hours of footage that were on those DVDs from multiple, you know, dozens probably of cameras around the Kuala Lumpur International Airport. But once we were able to piece it together, you know, it's almost like following six. It's almost like Where's Waldo? You're following six different Waldos throughout the day in a bustling international airport. So it's the two women and it's the four North Korean spies. And when you're able to trace those six people throughout the day, it's chilling. It's chilling in the sense that, you know, an assassination's about to happen. It was also really chilling in the sense that once we finished completing that puzzle, we were like, holy crap, everything that these women are saying, because we didn't believe them yet, is corroborated by the story of how this went down in the airport. And then it became all the more dire because it was looking like the women were going to be executed. And we were starting to think, wow, they might be telling the truth. They might be innocent.
Yeah. Your movie obviously deals a bit with the wider issues of what goes on in North Korea, this bizarre hereditary system they have that Kim Jong-un is now the leader. And also it looks at the character that the now deceased Kim Jong-nam was. And it's a fascinating picture of these two half-brothers with different mothers. And Kim Jong-nam, he was kind of, I don't want to say a laughable character, but he was, I found myself smiling occasionally. Before the assassination, obviously, like just he had tried to go to Disneyland in Japan. He lived in Macau. I was bizarrely in Macau for a day once when I was in Hong Kong. And my memory of it, I might have this wrong, is just it was just full of casinos. It just seemed like an adult Disneyland. So the idea that that's where he lived. Can you just give us a sense of what kind of character he seemed to you by the end of your research and making the movie?
Yeah, I think Kim Jong-nam is kind of lovable in that type of way. Like you mentioned the Tokyo Disneyland story, that's often pointed to as the reason he was passed up for the throne because he was the older brother. You know, he got arrested going into Japan under a fake passport, and it was hugely embarrassing to the North Korean regime. But he was just trying to take his toddler son to Disneyland. And so, you know, he had a dark past in his own way. He was involved in the world of gambling and money laundering. But I think he was also sort of lovable in a way and sort of innocuous in a lot of ways. Like, you know, was not interested in challenging his younger brother's leadership, you know. Mm-hmm. But he was always going to be a threat to Kim Jong-un as long as he lived, because he was the oldest brother and therefore he had a more direct lineage to you know, the mythology of Mount Paektu, the Mount Paektu bloodline down from Kim Il-sung. He was the only grandson of Kim Il-sung who actually met him, you know? So Kim Jong-nam, and he was much more Western leaning in his political philosophy. So he was, you know, going on camera when the media was running up to him at airport saying, I hope the North Korean people have a better life one day, or I don't believe there should be hereditary succession, but I wish my brother the best. And so his life, as long as he was living, he was always going to be a threat to Kim Jong-un. And many people think his days were numbered. In fact, there's rumors that there had been previous assassination attempts on Kim Jong-nam's life, to the point where he had sent his brother, Kim Jong-un, a letter begging for his life, saying, like, essentially, please stop trying to kill me.
Yeah. Now, what the movie also does is, you know, in the West, or certainly in this part of the world, we have an almost comic book character view of his half-brother, Kim Jong-un, that he's, you know, this South Park kind of guy. Oh, I want to play video games all day. I mean, your movie recasts him as a maniacal, you know, dictator that will do anything. And this is a right portrayal, as far as I can see, who will do anything to stay in power and control as much as possible. I'm wondering, in closing, I'm not saying from him, but have you had any North Korean reaction to your film?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't get emails from the North Korean regime giving us a letter grade on our film. I would love to hear what they thought. But, you know, you're right. I'm glad you brought that up, because I do think for so long in Western culture, we have caricatured Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-il, too, his father, you know, was in the Team America as a total joke. Kim Jong-un was in the, you know, the Sony film, The Interview, which led to the hack. And I hope our film does, to use your word, recast him in some ways as less of a caricature and less someone to be laughed at and more someone to be feared. I mean, this has been a very strategic rise to power and a consolidation of power over the last decade that Kim Jong-un has achieved. And this assassination played a key role in that. So, you know, I don't know what the North Korean regime thinks of my film. You know, I have to think that they orchestrated this assassination in such a public spectacle of a way for a reason. I can't say that we have felt comfortable over the past 2.5 years making this film. I think we've always been watching our backs or have been fearing that we're being watched, or definitely that our cybersecurity was at risk and we had multiple threats to our cybersecurity at different points. Whether that's the North Korean regime, I don't know. You know, even our film premiered at Sundance January of last year, and Duan, the Vietnamese woman, couldn't come because we couldn't get her a visa. And while I was there, she was communicating with me on Facebook in a very angry way, which is very uncharacteristic of Duan. And so I texted her, and she let me know that wasn't her communicating with me on Facebook. So someone was mimicking her Facebook profile in some way. So a lot of strange things like that happened during the course of the film. I'm very happy to be done with it and have it out in the world and have those fears allayed in some sort of way. But, you know, I think North Korea is very good at staying in the shadows. So to ever draw those direct lines would I think, be too, you know, too corollary on my part.
Let me ask you then, finally. So I've seen two documentaries that you made. One I mentioned at the start, The Keepers, and obviously this one, both of which I've enjoyed immensely. So I just have to ask, what's next for you? Because I'd love to know.
Well, I always love, I call my career ADD because I get to bounce around between totally different subject matters and tones. So the same time I was making Assassins, I was also making a documentary called Ask Dr. Ruth about the 90-year-old legendary sex therapist here in the U.S., a German refugee, which was a much funnier and lighter documentary, even though it's about the Holocaust as well. So I suppose I'm always looking for a certain amount of darkness. So I'm doing a couple documentaries that are very different in tone, one about the world of design for HBO here, and that I'm hopping back into the dark world that was, you know, sort of the focus of The Keepers and Assassins. I'm making a documentary about a murder here in Alabama that has all of those same type of layers. You know, I'm never just interested in true crime and whodunits, but I am very interested in crime stories that have huge layers of, you know, social inequity or systemic corruption. And this story in Alabama that I'm following has all of those rich layers. So that's always kind of what I'm looking for, is to hop between films that are a little more fun and light and enjoyable to be around, and then other ones that keep, you know, the adrenaline pumping and sort of keep me on the edge of my seat.
Sure. Well, you're doing that to viewers as well, so please keep doing it, because your work is fascinating. Ryan White, director of Assassins, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you for having me.
That's Ryan White, who you heard me talking to there about his fascinating new documentary, Assassins. Now, it's available on all sorts of digital platforms, Dogwolf on Demand, for instance, but in particular, it's available in IFI at Home, which is this fantastic streaming service from the great IFI, which is just one of my favorite cinemas in the world. They have a system where you don't have to subscribe. You can just go on and rent a movie. So why not, if you're going to watch it, rent it from IFI at Home. Up next, Sheila Shoiga on her favorite movie. You're listening to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well known about their favourite movie. I'm delighted now to be joined by broadcaster, lately podcaster, and I think it's fair to say an old friend of mine going way back, Sheila Shoiga. How are you?
Absolutely, John. Hey, great to talk to you again.
You too. So listen, your movie choice, I lay my cards on the table, is one of my favourite movies of all time,
without
question. Cool. So tell our listeners what it is.
I love that. Yeah, when you asked me what is your all-time favorite movie, you know, undoubtedly this was the one that jumped into my head straight away as being the one, and it's Dead Poets Society.
Oh, isn't it just beautiful? It sounds amazing. Like saying, tell us why water is wet, but tell us why you love it.
Yeah, I mean, I love it for so many reasons, probably very similar reasons to you. But I also watched it at an age where it just blew my mind. I was 14. I remember it was released a few years previous, but it was on RTE. And I remember recording it on tape. And luckily I did, because I went on then to, this is kind of a mad thing to admit to, but I actually...
On national radio, but go on.
Yeah, on national radio. I took out the cassette recorder. Back in the day when we used to actually have cassette recorders, I put in my blank tape. Do you remember we used to buy blank tapes?
Oh yeah, I sure do.
And I played the movie that I'd recorded off the telly. So I played it and I recorded the entirety of Dead Poets Society on a cassette tape so that I could play it over and over on my Walkman.
So just the dialogue?
Oh yeah, yeah, the whole film, John. Wow. So like when I say I'm a super fan, that's how... It absolutely, I suppose it just had such a profound impact on me, so much so that I remember our local priest, a gorgeous man, who like the following Sunday at the altar spoke about it as, you know, he did a sermon on the importance that all parents should watch this film and learn from it and not put pressure on their kids. And it was coming up to leaving cert time.
Yeah.
And I remember, like, I loved the man anyway. He was just, he was a good egg. And I was like, he's talking to my favorite film. It was just on TV and there he is. And it was such an important message, because anyone who's seen it will know that the beginning of the movie is fun and inspiring and romantic and uplifting and just go out there and live your life.
Just
yeah.
Remind people what it's about. Robin Williams.
Yeah, sorry. So Robin Williams is the school teacher. Yeah, I'm running away with myself. So he plays a school teacher called John Keating. And it's this private school in America called Welton. Mm. And he stands out like a sore thumb because he's really different to all the other teachers. He's all about, he's a nonconformist, and he's about, like, literally, and he does actually get them to rip up one of their school books in class. And he teaches them about, you know, being true to themselves and living every moment. And you know, he gives them a love of poetry,
yeah,
and prose, and that it's not to be found sitting in libraries, that it's actually to be found living in the world and experiencing life. And he inspires them, and he inspires, I suppose, anyone who watches the movie. So you're led on this, and you're this gorgeous, funny moments. And obviously Robin Williams, being Robin Williams, is genius, because he's, you know, he's doing all his impersonations and it's fabulous. It's just really uplifting and gorgeous. And then there's this twist later on in the movie that you don't really see coming, and I certainly at a 14-year-old did not see coming. Mm. And it and I actually have a tightness in my heart now when I think of it. I'm kind of almost afraid of revealing it, because I know people listening, many people would already have seen it, but there may be a few that haven't. But essentially one of the characters decides they can't live in this world anymore, and it's insanely tragic. And then it's what happens afterwards and how the blame is put on the John Keating character played by Robin Williams, and how it's absolutely not his fault at all. And then you have this other character who is played by Ethan Hawke, who starts out as this shy, awkward guy who then ends up being the bravest of them all. And he does something gorgeous at the end of the movie, and they all follow suit. And effectively, I suppose, you're learning lessons about having courage, having integrity, you know, and being true to yourself. And I suppose, look, when I think of it now, I mean, I suppose it's shaped me the whole way along, because that's what it is.
Well, I was going to say, in a way, it sounds like the movie possibly changed your life slightly.
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky that my folks have always been very much, you know, go with the flow, and whatever you're into, whatever you want to do, you know, we'll support that. So I've never had pressure from an academic point of view, because I was actually never that good at school anyway. So I was very fortunate not to have had that. But I certainly think it gave me permission. I've always been a bit of a dreamer. I've always been really romantic at heart, and it felt like it was speaking to me in a very real way, that it's actually okay to feel these things. It's okay to be an emotional person. It's okay to feel, and actually, in time, it'll become a strength. And I suppose I realize that now. I'm nearly 42. I'm not 14 anymore, but I've learned that actually, you know, beauty is to be found in simple things. And I suppose it kind of challenges your, what is life? What is it all about? What does success mean? And success is not about, you know, although it can be about achieving great things and having lots of money in the bank. But actually, when it comes down to it, it's about living and enjoying every moment, because unfortunately, none of us know what's around the corner. And that's a fact of life.
Yeah, that is beautifully described film. It really is. And, you know, it's funny when you told me what you were going to choose and I was saying to you, it's one of my favorite movies. I'd nearly find it hard to watch now because I'm 2 years older than you. So we're a similar ballpark. But so much has happened in anyone's life between 14 and now that, and I'm a father now, like you're a mother. The thoughts of sitting down and watching those young kids, like you talk about a tightness in your heart, I'd find it too tough to watch nearly, which is a great testament to a film, I guess. You know,
I totally agree with you. And, you know, I was thinking of other movies that I love as well. It's I think that's a real sign of sometimes some movies are so good that they only need to be watched once, because in a way, I don't think sometimes we can take another viewing, especially ones that are that pull on the heartstrings. And if they have that impact on you, you want to kind of preserve that. Now, obviously, I didn't, because I played it over and over and over on my Walkman. I literally could quote the movie inside out. But I know, obsessed. And then, of course, I was obsessed with the music. You know, beautiful French composer Maurice Jarre did the music. So I had the soundtrack. Sure, I was the ultimate Dead Poets Society fan. But yeah, I think maybe some movies are meant to be of a time and place, and if they have that impact on you, we'll then park that, hold on to that, and move on.
Yeah.
But I never knew. Obviously, there was the kind of life before Dead Poets and the life after, and that's how it felt for me as a 14-year-old. It really did.
Well, that is, as I say, brilliantly described, and it brings us nicely to one of your latest projects, which a lot of people are talking about, your new podcast, Ready to Be Real, with you, Sheila Shoiga. And I mean, I was only looking this week, Alistair Campbell, you've had Tommy Tiernan, and you've had all sorts of people getting real with you to varying degrees. What was the motivation for that? Because the world is awash with podcasts.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering why you wanted to enter the space.
Well, I mean, I suppose there's an element of jumping on the bandwagon because, as you said, the world and its mother seem to be podcasting at the moment. But I also, as you would know from my time being in News Talk, I love to chat. It's a pastime of mine. I love having deep conversations with people. I also like having the crack. So it was a way of me indulging a passion of mine. And that's effectively what it is. What I love about it is there's huge freedom in podcasting.
Yeah.
I don't have to worry about if a guest curses, we don't have to cut it out. Or if they say something, we don't have to worry about, you know, being sued or whatever it is. So there is huge freedom and that's liberating. It's gorgeous. It's great. And, you know, the variety of people I speak to, I suppose I love listening to podcasts myself. I'm still a fan of talk radio, don't get me wrong. There's a time and a place for everything, but I do like the freedom that you get, because we would all have felt it when we're doing radio or TV work. You only get a set amount of time with a guest and you're trying to cram in all of these questions or ideas you'd like to explore in a limited amount of time. You don't have that pressure of podcasting.
Yeah.
You just go with the flow and you let the guest talk and the conversation. I don't do questions, so it just takes you in a way, sometimes extremely unexpected directions, and that's the beauty of it, I think.
But I mean, it's, you know, the title, and I've listened to some of them, not just before this, but I have done over the year or however long you've been doing it, particularly one with Tommy Tiernan, I really enjoyed. But I mean, you're not just shooting the breeze with them. I mean, you are trying to get down to, I guess, the important stuff in their lives, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, Tommy is a great example of that because he's a deep thinker. I mean, he's obviously a great crack, but all we have to do is watch him do his own show on TV. He is incredible to watch. He's so intuitive and he's so intelligent, but he's also not afraid to go to areas that some people would find kind of scary, you know, exploring vulnerability and what makes us tick. And that's the stuff that I'm into. And, I suppose, why would that be the case with me now? It's because I went through my own stuff, you know.
Sure.
Like 10 years ago, I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer, and that was a scary time in my life. And I learned a lot of really brilliant things through that process. You know, I learned, I suppose, to going back to Dead Poets, to live, to seize the day, to carpe diem and not hold back. And I'm much more comfortable in my skin now. And I want to be real with people.
Yeah.
So I'm real with myself and I want to reflect that. And luckily, I think because the title is Ready to Be Real, it's almost like an unwritten contract that people sign,
sure,
sign before they sit down to have a chat, that they know, okay, I got to just be myself here. And everybody turns up and it's exactly what they do.
Yeah, brilliant. And then finally, right. Sorry, you're on talk radio, so I have to move you along. I'm awfully sorry. But you have another project, a new documentary coming out in April. Just tell us quickly about that.
Yeah, so it's a very personal documentary. It is on the topic of miscarriage. So essentially, I've had two, and I know that's not uncommon. And I feel extremely comfortable talking about it. And I suppose I was passionate about having more conversation around the topic. And then I discovered that there has never been a documentary made on the topic of miscarriage on Irish TV before, which I think says a lot. Yeah. So on the 7th of April, there'll be an hour long documentary broadcast on TG Cahad. And we've been working on it for the past year, and it's been tough to film through COVID. It's been really tricky, but we're getting there. We're nearly there. And it's a project I'm extremely proud of, and I hope we do the topic justice, because there are so many different opinions to consider and include in it. I hope people find it comforting and empowering, because there's a lot of people that still suffer in silence, and we want to break through that stigma. Yeah.
Well, that sounds like a very important project. Her favorite movie is Dead Poets Society. You can hear her on the Ready to Be Real podcast with Sheila Shoiga. She is one of those people who I can testify to that you hear about who has a good soul. Sheila, thank you very much.
John, thanks a million. Right back at you.
No matter what anybody tells you, words and ideas can change the world. Now, see that look in Mr. Pitt's eye? Like 19th century literature has nothing to do with going to business school or medical school, right? Maybe. Mr. Hopkins, you may agree with him, thinking, yes, we should simply study our Mr. Pritchard and learn our rhyme and meter and go quietly about the business of achieving other ambitions. A little secret for you. Huddle up. Huddle up! We don't read and write poetry because it's cute. We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race. And the human race is filled with passion.
A clip there from Dead Poets Society. And my thanks to Sheila Shoiga. And as I said to her, that movie, I haven't seen in a long time, but it's etched in my memory. But I don't think I could watch it again. I genuinely mean that. There's so much emotion in it. And the feelings I would have about the things that happen in it now compared to the feelings I would have had about it 20 years ago when I first saw it, or whatever, or maybe longer. There's too big a chasm. I know that's a strange thing to say, but that's a sign of a powerful movie. It's almost too good to rewatch. Anyway, that is it for this week. I want to thank Anne-Marie Kane, who helped on the show this week, as she does every week, taking care of all the business that I never get around to. So I'm very grateful to Anne-Marie, and I probably don't say it often enough, but there you go, Annie. I want to remind you this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com, the Newstalk app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. Next week, all going to plan, I will be talking to Michael Imperioli, as in Christopher from The Sopranos, which I'm very excited about. Leave you with some music from the movies. Oh, and I also just want to remind you, if you want to get in touch with me at any stage during the week, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Have a good week. Leave you with some music from the movies. One of the things to recommend Malcolm and Marie, the movie we were talking about earlier, is the fantastic soundtrack in it, and music plays a big part in the movie. And this song by William Bell, I Forgot to Be Your Lover, is used to wonderful effect. So I will leave you with that and wish you all a very safe and happy weekend.
Have I told you lately that I love you? Well, if I didn't, darling, I'm sorry. Did I reach out and hold you in my loving arms? Oh, when you needed me. Now I realize that you need love too, and I'll spend my life making up to you. Oh, I forgot to be your lover, and I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. Have I taken the time to share with you all the burdens that lovers bear? And have I done the little simple things to show you
just how much I care. Oh, I've been working for you, doing all I can, but work all the time didn't make me a man. Oh, I forgot to be your lover, and I'm sorry, I'll make it up to you somehow, baby.
A new year is full of surprises, but one thing is always predictable. Postage costs go up. Stamps.com gives you crazy discounts of up to 89% off USPS and UPS services. So when postage goes up, your business will barely notice the change. Stamps.com is like your own personal post office, wherever you are. You can even take care of orders on the go with the mobile app. No lines, no traffic, no waiting. Schedule package pickups, automatically find the cheapest and fastest shipping options, and seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. There's even a supply store where you can stock up on mailing supplies, labels, even printers. Stamps.com has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses just like yours. All you need is a computer or phone and printer. Take a chunk out of your mailing and shipping costs this year with Stamps.com. Sign up with promo code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com code PROGRAM.